Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. Over the last couple of weeks, we've been doing a review of what's been going on in the world over the past year and what we saw going into the future. We purposely danced around the Middle East because we knew we'd be talking about it right away at the beginning of the year. And so here we are, our third session of the year, and I'd like to talk a little bit about Egypt with you gentlemen. Austin, you just wrote a piece on Egypt on the site, and I'd just like you to comment on that because it's an interesting perspective that we don't see in the mainstream media. Usually we see a left view or a right view. Everything's going, you know, we've got freedom, you know, the Arab Spring's going well, and then we've got the right saying, well, you know, this is going to end in total disaster and like that. But you took more of a long view. Would you comment on that?
Well, I think I've taken a long view from the beginning, and I think that the long view is the strategy page concept. I mean, Jim starts out, you know, the news is history, and try to bring some depth and context to what goes on. It's not that we don't have opinions. We do have opinions, but we also want to try to bring some, in our commentary and analysis, historical depth. And Dan, if we go back to some of our strategy talks, we can also, I know I said this for sure on a C-SPAN panel that I was on in October of 2011. It was dedicated to Arab Spring. It was at the Texas Book Festival. We're not going to know how Arab Spring comes up for 30 or 40 years. And sometimes I've said it at least 30 or 40 years. Now, in this week's column, I said, ask me if the Egyptian revolution was successful in, what did I say, in January of 2033? You know, so I'm moving out 20 years on it. We're talking in decades before we evaluate it because, look, the roots of the 2011 revolts, you can trace them back, in Egypt's case, back to, 1952, when the Free Officers Movement, I believe that was one way to translate Nasser's group, overthrew King Farouk. But you can go back, really, as I do, to World War One, and some things that were happening in the Ottoman Empire in the late 19th, early 20th century, effects of railroad and telegraph, among others. Of course, we're starting to move into the telephone in the early 20th century, and profound effects, not just in the Middle East, but throughout the world in terms of the acceleration of being it for people able to move, human ability to travel great distances quickly, and for information to move very, very quickly. And 2011 in some ways is a expression of things that should have happened or could have happened in the 1918-1919 time frame, post World War One, and you get into Sykes-Picot and the France and Great Britain turning the Arab vignettes of the Ottoman Empire into essentially economic satrapies, and democracy was for everybody except the Arabs. At least that's the way the Arabs, many of the Arabs took it in after World War One. So those roots right there, which I've tried to wrap up in about a minute and a half, are usually ignored. Sometimes you see them in a longer essays, appearing on something, Foreign Affairs or some of the other news sites that will offer extended analysis. But those were in background to our analysis on Strategy Page when Tunisia started erupting in late December, early January, late December 2010, early January 2011. So, if we talk about Egypt, we've got to talk about definitely talk about World War One. I think I've covered it for our purposes today, but also take a look at the nature of revolutions themselves. And so my piece this week starts out and says that I think, and I meant this to say that succinctly and underwhelmingly, that to declare the Egyptian Revolution a failure 2 years after this very complex, and I'll call it the drastic political change, is expressed. I can't just say it begins. I think I did say begins in the intro, but the express is hasty. Well, I could have been much harder than that, Dan. I think it's really wrong-headed to do it. And so then I went into a discussion of really the first 10 years of the French Revolution, actually in a paragraph and a half that I have about the French Revolution. I'm taking it from 1789 to really 1804. I don't mention it, but that's when Napoleon crowns himself emperor. But the coup d'etat over the Republic takes place in 1799. And the first 5 years of the French Revolution between 1789 and late 1794 were highly chaotic and anarchic. And then 1795, you've assembled the Constitutional Republic, but it ain't over. It ain't, like Yogi Berra says, it ain't over until it's over. And France remained unsettled, Republican France, arguably until the beginning of the 20th century. And then, of course, it's utterly disrupted itself by World War One and the trenches. So you're looking at France, the effects of the French Revolution, and what kind of system is France going to have, certainly going into the middle of the 19th century. How do you judge the French Revolution? Was it a liberating revolution? Yes, it was. Was it fraught with extraordinary bloodshed, terror? The terror, you know, is with the Jacobins are in charge, really, in Paris. Yeah, absolutely. Then I also mentioned briefly the U.S. Revolution. Was the American Revolution successful? I think it's been highly successful, but I point out that in the United States, which it's a political entity formed on this proposition, many propositions, but this one's central to it, that all men are created equal. All men are created equal. I mean, that crops up. That's a central idea in the Declaration of Independence. It is an idea that is certainly carried forth in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, you know, sense of individual protection of individual liberty and the like. But we permit, the United States permits chattel slavery, at least in some of its southern states. And chattel slavery is a complete flip on all men are created equal, and you're going to permit slavery. The U.S. has, up to its time, was one of the, when it occurred, one of the most bloody, in terms of per capita, civil wars anyone had ever fought to adjudicate on the battlefield that mistake in the American Revolution. Now, I spent more time here than I did in the column, but just that it's not settled. There were problems in the way the American Revolution, it wasn't all done and not over. So, if you take those two examples, and they are not in the Middle East, one is France and then the United States, well, let's take a look at poor Egypt. Now, I did not say this. I did think about it, but you got to stay within, you know, I think I came in at about 650 words instead of 6,500. But, you know, Egypt is the one place on the planet that can point to about, you know, 7,000 years of recorded history, even more than China. So you're talking about a place that has real history. Now, they're certainly aware of it. Real culture, and for all the turmoil and issues that have have gone hammered Egypt for the last two millennia. They've got some deep roots, the deepest, arguably, at least in terms of, again, as I said, recorded history. To say that they failed is wrongheaded. Now, to look at what is occurring, here's where my take on this, I think, is different than what the way you set it up, a quote-unquote left-right or a political interpretation. I go into an analysis of what is the dread, and it's the dark shadow looming over all of the Arab Spring revolts. And when we talk about Arab Spring revolts, remember there was also one in Bahrain, one in Yemen, but we pretty much talk about those in the Mediterranean littoral. And the old Roman provinces, every single one of them. But that's the Iranian revolution and the theocracy that the Ayatollah Khomeini imposed, the destruction, the dismal situation that exists and persists in Iran. And, the Muslim Brotherhood, where Mohammed Morsi, who's president, proved to be the most powerful political force in Egypt, at least in terms of electoral politics. Just quick sidebar on this. I think I may write on this in the next couple of months. This is no surprise. If you read Bernard Lewis's latest book, even though Dr. Lewis has been saying this for decades, the mosque and groups like the Muslim Brotherhood are the strongest political forces because they operate as a, not just a religious group, but they've been a civic group where people could meet and discuss ideas at the mosque with some removal from the scrutiny of the state, or at least the state shutting down your discussion. And in the state, in these cases, there were dictatorships. So a Muslim Brotherhood has several legs up on any other groups in these in these revolutionary countries. They're organized, and they're quickly for elements of them to turn into a political party. It's no surprise, in other words, that a Muslim Brotherhood president got elected in Egypt in a fair and square election. I will say it was a bit of a surprise to see how much the opposition candidate did well. And even though there's another problem, too, in the way that the Egyptian politics are framed, they call the opposition secularists. Well, there are some of them that are secularists, some of the leftists that are in the National Salvation Front. They're there. But a number of them happen to be Arab Christians. A number of them happen to be Muslims. And some are moving into the National Salvation Front, which is headed by Mohammed al-Baradei, who used to be on the UN's atomic energy investigation agency, IAEA, I think it is, International Atomic Energy Agency, which meant he was one of the people charged with investigating Saddam. Well, they're also in charge with investigating Iran. Baradei is a Muslim. And I was also meant to say that there are people who have been in the Muslim Brotherhood, have been moving the moderate Islamists, have been moving into the National Salvation Front. One of the things that may have been occurring because of the anger expressed at Morsi and also the anarchy that's occurred in Port Said and in Cairo, the violent demonstrations, and I'll come to the court case here in a second, is that there are a lot of political Islamists that are moderates saying, this isn't working, and Morsi has alienated many important revolutionary segments. So, that's an important point. Alienated many important revolutionary asset segments, factions. These include these secularists, moderate Islamists, and the like. Let's go back to the Iranian revolution. Abul Hassan Bani Sadr was the first elected president, and he was a moderate. But by 1981, within, actually, I think a year and a half of the election. He was in exile because Khomeini wanted to jail him, and the hardline Islamists, the tyrants, now part of the regime in Iran, the Khomeiniist regime, were going after the moderates. And Bonnie Sauter wrote very early in January 2011, he was writing it primarily to the Tunisians, but Egypt was breaking out as well. He says, unless you want to end up like Iran's end up, revolutionaries must have a united democratic front, and you must focus on individual rights. You must do that, individual rights and protecting democracy. Mohamed Morsi made several mistakes after he's elected fair and square. Instead of doing something, and let's give Jim kudos on this. Jim said the thing he's got to go after. He go back and listen to this, our discussions in 2011. Whoever is in charge in Egypt is going to have to work on the economy. They're going to have to produce real economic success. That is the way to carry it forward. And part and parcel of that is ending the corruption among the oligarchs and among the Egyptian military. I mean, parts of the military are extremely corrupt in their actions within the government and within the economy. And that's going to take a focused effort. It's going to take a united front. But what does Morsi do? He does what the more hardline, I didn't call them extremists. The extremists are Al-Qaeda guys like, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's now head of Al-Qaeda. He was the extremist element of the Muslim Brotherhood. But the hardline elements wanted Sharia enshrined in the Constitution. Morsi did that, and they rammed it down the throats of their secularist and moderate opponents. That split the revolution right there. The other thing is that Morsi, and now when Jim gets on here in a sec, you know, Jim may express some deserved sympathy for Morsi, because Morsi realized that the courts, there's plenty of appointees from the Mubarak and Nasser areas, Mubarak, Sadat, Nasser areas, in the courts. There are plenty of the government bureaucrats that are owe their allegiance ultimately to the Mubarak regime or the Mubarak era, and he wasn't making much headway with those folks. But instead of doing it through the parliament, why darn, he wants emergency powers, and emergency powers is code words for dictatorial powers. Mubarak did that. Well, right there, he shattered the Democratic Front. And what has emerged out of this, and this is the conclusion of that column, and this is something I haven't seen this anyplace else, but I was watching it occur, I thought it was time to put it in print, is that if Morsi hasn't learned this, I think the Egyptian military, a lot of smart people in there have realized it, and the opposition certainly has, is that the Muslim Brotherhood may be a power base enough to get you elected, but it is not a power base enough to govern, and it's certainly not a power base to begin and sustain the kind of political focus it takes to bring about fundamental economic reform. And there's your lesson right there. If you're going to go and you're going to say, we won. Yeah, we want it. Now you're going to eat it. We're going to make you, our religion is going to preempt the revolution. It comes first. Guess what? There's, at least in Egypt, and I think this obtains in Tunisia as well, probably in Libya, but again, Tunisia and Libya are more, they're different kind of cases than in Egypt. But if you are going to succeed at what were the shared revolutionary goals, and I will say, the goals that Egypt needs to enter the late 20th century, much less the 21st century, economic reform, legal reform, continuing the political reforms, you're not going to do it with a Muslim Brotherhood. And I even, again, I'm hardliners or committed Muslim brothers, but they're not terrorists. They're not the extremists on this. They don't have don't provide the base to carry that out. It's going to have to come in the Egyptian version of what Bonnie Sauter said about a united democratic front. Now, here's the lesson on that. Is Morsi smart enough to see it? Well, does that mean they're going to have to cash in the Sharia out of the Constitution? I don't know. That would be a really tough thing to eat. Is it going to lead to another election where a more moderate Muslim brother is elected, or maybe al-Baradei or Amir Moussa, who's a National Salvation Front politician, is elected president? Is this going to lead to some moderation among Muslim brother hardliners, because I said, you know, we're going to lose everything? I didn't go into this as a scenario, but the army is sitting back there, the corrupt elements of the army, saying we're just biding our time. All these guys fail, and then we step in, and it's Nasser Mubarak with a different face and some moderation and a new constitution. Or they have, another election, and they go about saying, hey, we're going to have to modify this and realize we're in for a longer haul. Every one of those scenarios, Dan, does not necessarily mean failure. It just means it's going to take a while for this to work out. And I think the economic pressure towards economic modernization and reform is ultimately the determinant. I will. Thank you for the time, Dan.
Yeah. Jim, if you have any comments on what Austin said, go ahead and pitch in. But one of the things I'd like you to do is sort of look at what has recently happened with, apparently we have our Egyptian version of the soccer wars going on.
Well, it's actually the violence in the last week or so, which has caused hundreds of casualties, is the culmination of frustration over many of the policies of the new government that Austin discussed, you know, the new constitution, the lack of change in the bureaucracy. I mentioned this early on. The main problem in Egypt was not just replacing Mubarak, but replacing his, for want of a better word, minions. What keeps the Egyptian society functioning in a lackadaisical way that it does function, is a corrupt system of officials and business families, actually, and the army, which is also, in effect, a collection of business families. Many family fortunes have been made because you had someone, the founder of a family fortune, became a general in the army, and basically went into business with military money and military connections and military power. This is what kept Mubarak going. And this coalition basically abandoned Mubarak, feeling that he was old. And his son was not considered a suitable replacement. That doesn't get much, you know, play in the media, but that's, from what Egyptians tell me, that's what was going on with the insiders. The revolution overthrew Mubarak, but the army adroitly, you know, stepped aside and said, hey, we're on your side, we're revolutionaries, partly because most of the soldiers were conscripts and weren't keen on shooting, you know, their own people, as it were, and partly because the minions had lost faith in their boss. Then, when Mubarak is gone and they say, well, let's hold elections. Well, elections are nothing new for Egypt. They've been having elections for generations. The problem is guys like Mubarak are president for life because they rigged the elections. So the bureaucracy is already there to hold new elections. And these were apparently fairly straightforward, although there were people running for election who, in effect, represented the minions. But it was a day the minions realized we better not try and steal this one because it would be too obvious, and then they come after the people who really control the country. So Morsi gets in. They put Mubarak on trial. He's convicted, but then he appeals. And surprise, surprise, all the judges, or most of the judges, are people, you know, the minions and Mubarak, you know, put in their jobs. The appeals court says you got to try them again. You know, there were technical problems. And basically, the people, the revolutionaries, well, meaning most of the population, realized that, you know, nothing is really changing. In fact, things are getting worse. The tourism business, which employs about, you know, 1 in 8 Egyptians who have jobs, it took a real hit because people were afraid to go. The place was in chaos. And it's close to half of the tourism income is down, is out, is not there anymore. So, and then a lot of the businesses basically got real conservative. They basically said, somewhat reasonably, don't invest any more money, don't expand. Let's wait and see how things really, you know, play out. Because the minions are afraid that, you know, the revolution might come after them. Now, that would be suicidal because, as Austin was pointing out, revolutions can be very messy, and they can basically leave people worse off than before the revolution, which many people say happened to France, but there's a certain amount of truth. People are upset because there's no food. People who didn't have much to begin with have less. The people who have a lot are fairly comfortable. I mean, some of them sent families outside the country, but they're just basically keeping their heads down, and they're not starving. You know, they have flat-screen TVs, and they can go on vacations, and they basically have a cushion. They can afford to wait it out. The people cannot, and neither can Morsi. And there's not much Morsi can do. As Austin pointed out, it's a long-term solution, but President Morsi is a recently elected president of a country that expects him to perform miracles. And, you know, miracles only happen in movies. And unfortunately, you know, Morsi's on a reality show. So, I mean, he's in big trouble. And the solution is probably one of his successors, not the next successor, maybe the successor after that. Because the minions are still waiting for things to go, for the opportunity to go back to business as usual. And I thought it might be a military coup. It might be an election, getting a minion candidate elected who convinces people, look, I know all the thugs, you know, who've kept this ramshackle, you know, government and cult society going for decades. I can at least get you back to where it was when Mubarak was in power. Now, that may sound like an insane election pitch, but a lot of Egyptians would accept that. I mean, like I say, these people are really hurting. I mean, we're talking literal starvation in some cases. But careers are being destroyed. People, you know, the schools aren't functioning well. It's just chaos. And, you know, so to make people who haven't got much to begin with take a hit, and just grin and bear it is asking an awful lot. And so it's quite possible that the minions, that the basically who created and sustained Mubarak, will be back in power. You know, Revenge of the Minions. I'd be a great movie, and it wouldn't be a comedy. But that's basically what's playing out in Egypt.
Well, one of the minions would be Amr Moussa, who was part of the old regime.
Yes, exactly. All those guys are basically keeping their heads down because they know, you know, they must read strategy page. They know that time is on their side. The revolutionary, the people supporting the revolution, cannot afford a long wait because they'll starve to death.
Right. Well, we know that we have people from Egypt reading the page. We just don't know who they are.
Well, actually, no. I have a couple people who over there who send me, you know, carefully written emails because there's a widespread belief, which may be true. I haven't been able to track that in a fact yet, but apparently the government, somebody in the government, is doing a fairly good job of monitoring email traffic. If you use encryption, that'll get you tagged too. So there's more going on over there than, you know, they can publish in the newspapers even. But the people in Egypt are basically afraid because what they thought, the new tomorrow they thought they had turned into a new nightmare. And nobody knows what to do.
Now,
well, there are people that know what to do. The thing is, though, it is something that requires a long-term effort, and the short-term pressures, as you said, hey, am I going to eat? Am I going to
survive?
Those components are tough to deal with.
No, but you have to consider, I mean, this is something that rarely gets addressed. The society, the Egyptian society, the way the culture is set up, the devil is in the details. You have a country that has no natural resources. They have no oil money. They basically have to, I mean, they, to a certain amount they get handouts, but not that much, you know, per capita. So they have to make it on their own resources. And their own resources are much weakened because they have too many people. You know, they can't export them fast enough. I mean, if you cut off the remittances from the Gulf states, Egypt would collapse, you know, in 48 hours. You know, it's very basically they have a very thin, safety net, which could easily, you know, fall apart if too much pressure is placed on it. And that is the essential problem. If they tinker with something, the whole thing might collapse. I mean, Egyptians are scared. Because the Egyptian, I mean, you know, the people on the street, they can yell, do this, but that's you can ignore that because they don't know what the hell they're talking about. The people who actually turn the levers, who make things work, you know, the middle management, the bureaucracy, a lot of them are revolutionaries. But the people who have the most power, the most money, they are not going to give it up easily. They'll sabotage it as they leave, and everybody knows that. Everybody, the bureaucracy, the minions, as I love to call them, are willing to make a deal, but they feel they're operating, they're negotiating from a position of strength. And Morsi has learned that they're right. I mean, why hasn't he gotten rid of all the judges? Because there aren't that many good candidates to go in there and do the job. I mean, the people that Mubarak had in there were basically, you know, on paper, you know, competent, you know, decent jurists. How do you find enough competent and uncorruptible jurists in Egypt? Morsi hasn't been able to do that.
Yeah, and he's getting some of the people that he's had sent to him are incompetent. They may know their Quran, but they don't.
Exactly. And another problem you have is you have a culture of corruption in Egypt, because even the Muslim Brotherhood has become corrupt. And of course we all know how quickly the pure of heart, you know, Islamic conservatives become corrupt. I mean, we've seen that played out again and again in Iran and Pakistan and everywhere, while in Saudi Arabia. Well, the Saudis never pretended to be corrupt. They take umbrage when you accuse them of corruption. They say, no, that's the way we do business here. Are you guys crazy? So, I mean, there's definitely a culture clash going on there. But for Egypt, which has, what, 60, what is it, 60 million people?
I think it's more than that. I think it's 70.
A lot of hungry people and no natural resources. So they have to basically make it on their own. And even if they pledge to the UN, oh, give us free food and whatnot, that's more free food than the international aid system can generate. So you basically got a basket case that is too big to handle.
One last question before we wrap this up. Is there a release valve that Morsi can turn to get his people outward focused rather than inward focused at this point that would override that frustration that is occurring internally and divert it to an outside source?
Well, you mean like blame the Israelis?
Oh, yeah. Maybe the Israelis are always...
He tried that, and it's basically some of his largest aid contributors said, we'll cut you off.
Yeah, he tried to stand there.
He went to Europe.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Jim. Go ahead.
He tried to... He casually dropped some anti-Semitic, you know, comments, which would mean nothing in Egypt. You know, that's just what people say day to day. And he caught hell for that. That's another big problem in the Arab world in general, is that they've been preaching this anti-Semitic, you know, anti-Israel hate, and to a certain extent anti-Western hate, you know, for years. Indeed, as Austin was pointing out, you got to look at the past history, you know, the after World War I, and I say, even back to the Turkish period and the 19th century. I mean, actually, the Turks lost Egypt to the British in the 19th century, but go centuries back before that with the Turks running the place, they got this whole attitude towards the outsider, where they love to blame the outsider for all their problems, but nobody wants to take responsibility and fix things. Which has been the problem when Nasser took over, he was basically saying, it's a new dawn, we are in charge, we will fix it. Well, we all know how well that turned out. That has not been fixed.
I'll make a
quick comment on that. Even playing it's the outsiders who are the problem card goes back to Muhammad Ali. He happened to be an Albanian.
The original Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, the original Muhammad Ali. Yeah, of the early 19th century in Egypt. But look. The Israeli card, Jim's right, Morsi tried to play it, but Dan, go and read about Morsi's recent trip to Germany and what he had to say it wasn't just Angela Merkel and her government, even though they confronted him about it. The German press got on to him about some of his statements, and he had to say, no, this is one of the most important things I have to do. I must maintain is our relationship with Israel, and it was done in a such a way that, you know, the Egyptian television, you know, there's government television, but there's also, thanks to the Internet, and Jim was kind of alluding to this, there's a porosity out of Egypt. It may be watched by the intelligence services, but some of it is just, you know, you read what folks have to say, and it reflects the disenchantment, the disgust, and fear that Jim was alluding to. I mean, so what I'm saying is that what he said and his response to the Germans is back in Egypt, unedited. It was just, no, this is important, and it was taken out of context, what I said. I was talking about when people do their X, Y, Z. Well, I don't know that it was taken out of context. It was ugly. It was anti-Semitic and vile, but he was having to say, well, that was domestic content. Uh-oh, there is no more domestic content. It's out all over the world, and I'm going to have to eat it. Why? Well, Jim just said major donors. Germany, I'm not sure how much aid Germany provides to Egypt, but Germany is extremely influential, Dan, as you know, economically on the planet, one of the easily top five most economically influential countries on this planet, if not in the top four. I don't think Jim would disagree with that, and we know who the others are. He's had to do that.
Be continuing to watch this basket case for some time with our long view here at Strategy Page, and we'll see you next time, Jim and Austin.
Take care.
Bye.